PEPFAR, the U.S. president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, has been credited with saving millions of lives in Africa. But as the new head of PEPFAR, Ambassador Dr. John Nkengasong, explains, the impact of PEPFAR extends even further beyond those who receive the life-saving treatment.
We all know about Omicron, and when we discuss Omicron, we all link it to where it was first discovered in Botswana and South Africa, and those were platforms that PEPFAR has put in place to pick that. So in other words, because of this same investment that we put overseas, we are very directly protecting ourselves here in the United States because of the interconnectivity that COVID has taught us.
Ambassador Nkengasong, the first African-born head of PEPFAR, tells us about life in Cameroon under fear of malaria, the impact of PEPFAR that he's seen with his own eyes, and what's next for the groundbreaking platform. I'm Andrew Kaufman, and this is The Strategist, presented by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. It is an honor to introduce today's guest, Ambassador Dr. John Nkengasong, who a year ago, almost to the day, he was nominated by President Biden to be the United States Global AIDS Coordinator and Special Representative for Health Diplomacy, in which role he leads the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, better known as PEPFAR. The Senate confirmed him in June, and we couldn't be more thrilled and honored to have him here. Ambassador Nkengasong, welcome to the Bush Center.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're so thrilled. And our co-host is the Bush Institute's local global health expert, Senior Manager Crystal Kazir. Crystal, thanks for spending some time.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on.
So we love talking to leaders from all walks of life, and everyone has a unique story, and I think your story is particularly unique as well. Could you walk us through your early life and how you came to be in medicine?
No, thank you again for having me on your program. I'm truly excited to be here. And as I said earlier, I've been in Dallas, but not had the opportunity to visit the Bush Institute, which I just toured. It's a remarkable institute and full of really fun memories of PEPFAR and what PEPFAR has done, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. First of all, let me say that it is truly humbling. At the same time, an honor for me to have been selected by President Biden to lead this incredible, impactful, successful program. In my 32 years of global health and public health, I don't think I know of any program that has been this impactful in narrowing the gaps in inequities, and especially in vulnerable populations, as PEPFAR has done. So I'm truly honored. I was born in Cameroon. Grew up to the age of 23 in Cameroon. That is just after graduating from college, and left Cameroon and studied in Europe. But before that, I was a typical child. I mean, at that time, where a young adolescent, you've graduated, but you are very confused with life. You don't know what to do with that.
Right.
You are,
yeah.
And I happened to be the only child from my mother, and I was also born late. I mean, when she was in the 50s, so you had that mixture of a child that had enjoyed that protection from home, and which you were not under any pressure. And I wanted, first of all, to do a graduate program in wildlife.
Oh, interesting.
And I don't know why I wanted to do that, because it was just fun. I mean, but I'll come back to that later.
Then, okay.
Then I changed my mind. I was reading books in the library. I mean, typical old-fashioned library where you take cards and you go to with the librarian, they pull a book out. And I read about entomology, the studies of insects. And it just occurred to me that the insects they could hurt people a lot. I mean, human beings, like malaria, was transmitted by the mosquitoes and other things. And I also realized that insects created a lot of harm to plants. So I thought, well, maybe I should do a career in or study. It was not about a career at that time. It was just about study how insects harm plants and humans. Then I changed my mind again, and I bumped into a professor in Cameroon who was a very renowned cancer researcher, and he said, the study of viruses can be very exciting because they cause all kinds of things, cancer, they cause a lot of deaths. And I said, at that time, a light bulb ignited on my mind, and I said to me, this is what I want to do. And so I've stayed 1 year out of college just not doing anything, but not because there were not opportunities, just because I wasn't focused. I was still wandering around what to do. And that was around 1988. And HIV/AIDS had just been described in 1981. And I joined the medical school, was in the laboratory looking at the very first specimens or blood samples taken from pregnant women in Cameroon to look at HIV/AIDS. And if it was there, first of all, I remember this was just about 6 years or 7 years after HIV was described. Then I bumped into a Professor Peter Piot, who came from a Belgian scientist, microbiologist, who arrived Cameroon and to develop partnerships with researchers in Cameroon to look into HIV/AIDS. And it was midday. And later on, you tell me that I struck him because it was midday. And the tradition and culture at that time is that because of the harsh climate, work will start at 8 o'clock in the morning to 12, and then people will go home take a break, come back after 2 hours. But at that time he came, I was in the laboratory, and a young 24 years old doing testing. So that became a turning point in my career where he said, you have potentials, and I would like you to come to the Institute of Tropical Medicine in Belgium to study virology. So I left the following year off on a scholarship, Belgian Corporation Scholarship to Belgium, and spent the rest is history. Developed my entire career there, then went to the medical school, University of Brussels Medical School, and studied, completed a PhD in medical sciences. And that's my long and short my journey from Alako childhood to developing, becoming a researcher.
So interesting too. You mentioned the insects and how they could transmit malaria. And malaria is something that affected you personally, right?
Absolutely. When I was growing up, right up to university, that is graduating at the age of 22, 23, I always thought I was going to die. And for several reasons, I saw friends that had died. And playmates that had died in elementary school because of malaria. Then you see them this week, and the next week they caught malaria, high fever, convulsion, they died. So it was common. You had to accept that the day or the next week was going to be a last week. And it became so complex because of the way medicine was practiced. In other words, when you had fever, you met a doctor, and they prescribe you medicine to lower your temperature, which was mainly Tylenol, and then the real treatment for malaria, which was they either nevaquine to treat malaria or chloroquine. But those malaria treatment drugs were more expensive than the Tylenol. So you show it over the counter, and you ask the pharmacist to give you, first of all, the cost of whatever. So the cost of Tylenol was a few dollars. So you say, I want that, then forget about the second drug, which was the main malaria, because you didn't have the money to buy that drug. So you go take your pain relief or fever relief medication. The fever goes down for 2 days, and you feel like you are okay, but after that, you get back, you relapse. You go that. So it goes on and on. So you are really not out of the malaria circle just because you don't have the money to buy the malaria drugs. So because of that, you become anemic, you don't go to school, you don't eat well. So it just becomes a vicious cycle because of the the lack of resources to treat yourself properly. So that also became a very important factor where I saw that the study of insects was central to the fight against malaria, which is still very, very a big problem today in Africa. About 500,000 children die of malaria every year in Africa.
Right. So that inequity that we saw with malaria and are still seeing, but it has been helped some through President's Malaria Initiative and Global Fund to Fight HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. It seems similar to the inequities that we saw at the beginning of HIV, AIDS, where ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, were available in high-income places, but not in places like sub-Saharan Africa. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like working in HIV AIDS from the late 80s until now and the milestones that you've seen in the fight against HIV AIDS globally throughout your career?
You're absolutely right. In the early 90s to the mid-90s, before that, we lived in an area of HIV AIDS where it was characterized by fear, by misery. People were miserable. People were hopeless. I think that is the right word I'm looking for, because we could, as medical and public health experts, all you could do was to test people and tell them that they were HIV positive. And so what do you do with that? But in the mid-90s, specifically in 1996, science made a significant breakthrough. Highly active drugs for treating HIV/AIDS were available. And we saw that death rates decreased drastically in the developed countries. Drastically, was almost magical. But the drugs were not available in developing countries, especially in Africa, where at that time it costed about $10,000 per treatment per year. So fast forward in the early 2000s, thanks to the political leadership and the generosity of heart of the American people, in 2003, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief was established. Again, thanks to the generosity of the U.S. taxpayers. And it created what I call a miracle, because it introduced those drugs that have been available for 10 years in the developed world into Africa and developing countries. And I must add that between 1996 and 2003, when the PEPFAR program, the treatment program, started in Africa, about 12 million Africans died because of HIV/AIDS. And that's why I've always characterized the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, the treatment program that President Bush started, and thanks to the United States taxpayers' money, as the greatest act of humanity, because it showed that we cared about what happens in a distant place. It showed that we share humanity, the values, the core values of relieving suffering. It showed that we care, that people, we offered hope to a population that was hopeless. And it has transformed the landscape completely today. Again, in the history of infectious diseases, I don't know that there's any strong political leadership that has been that impactful in transforming the way that we focus on address and tackle one single disease. So 2003 was transformational and continues to be transformational. Look, when we go into countries like Eswatini, Botswana, South Africa, Ivory Coast, you don't see clinics full of people that were infected with HIV/AIDS. And that was what was happening in the early 2000s. Huge wards were full of people. They were like skeletons, sunken jaws. You could barely recognize someone that was your relative but had HIV/AIDS. today those beds are empty. Now they are completely overtaken by other things. That, I mean, that is truly a source of celebration, and that we should step back, look back at the last 19 or 20 years of what the generosity of the American people have done in saving humanity. I think when the history of HIV/AIDS will be written, that chapter, that generosity chapter expressed by the U.S. President's emergency plans for AIDS relief will occupy several chapters in that book.
And what's interesting too now is as PEPFAR now is nearing 20 years, we've learned at the time some of the challenges were around delivery of medicines and making sure that remote communities could have access to the drugs. And we see now we've learned a lot of lessons that get applied to COVID. Can you talk some about how PEPFAR has been more than just a relief program, but a partnership that helps deliver these drugs?
The PEPFAR program has been more than just treating people. It has been about strengthening the overall healthcare systems in countries that we run these programs. Just run some numbers with you. PEPFAR has trained over just in the last 2 years, not cumulatively over 19 years, but just the last 2 years, about 300,000 healthcare workers in countries that the programs operate. Has strengthened over 70,000 healthcare facilities. Has established or strengthened over 3,000 laboratories. And has developed strong supply chain management systems from end to end to deliver HIV drugs in the most remote areas. Because of that, when COVID hit most of these countries, that same infrastructure was leveraged on in fighting COVID in the areas of expanded testing, in the area of infection prevention and control, in the areas of vaccination. In countries like Zambia, we saw that they were vaccinating about 5,000 people a day. And because of PEPFAR platform, they scaled that up to about 15,000 people a day. Very, very practical. We are seeing that when you have cholera outbreaks or large measles outbreaks, the same healthcare workers, the same laboratories that PEPFAR has supported are leveraged now to supporting that. Monkeypox, I'll just say that we all know about Omicron. And when we discuss Omicron, we all link it to where it was first discovered in Botswana and South Africa. And those were platforms that PEPFAR has put in place to pick that. So in other words, because of this same investment that we put overseas, we are very directly protecting ourselves here in the United States because of the interconnectivity that COVID has taught us. At least three big lessons: that what happens in a distant away country affects us directly. It took only 20 days for COVID to emerge in China and affected 65 countries within 20 days. We saw what happened with Omicron. The scientists in South Africa identified it, and within weeks, it was all over the world. But thanks to this PEPFAR infrastructure, they were able to use that to roll out vaccinations, do testing, and do genomic analysis, that is, understanding how the variants were emerging. So what really it shows us, lastly, is the interconnectivity, that we are so interconnected. Once upon a time, we thought that global health or public or international health was something that we did for somebody in a distant country. No, by doing that, we are directly protecting ourselves from these very dangerous pathogens that are continuing to emerge. This time, we're dealing with COVID as we speak, but we're also dealing with monkeypox as we speak. But monkeypox has been circulating in Africa, in Central Africa, for years. So the same platform that we are putting in place, thanks to the PEPFAR program, can be used, are being used, and leveraged to fighting monkeypox. Same with Ebola outbreaks. The massive Ebola outbreak we saw in West Africa, in those three countries, if they had happened in countries that we had PEPFAR investment, I bet you it wouldn't have been such a devastation that or devastating as we saw in 2014 and 2016.
We're all in this together. That's the bottom line. We are
in this together.
We're all in this together.
Yeah.
It's true. So we've talked a lot about what PEPFAR has done, right? But you are just over 100 days into your tenure as the leader of PEPFAR. And I want to talk about what's next. What's next for PEPFAR? Last week, you released the strategy for the rest of your tenure in office. So talk about that.
No, absolutely. We have seen, as I've outlined here, the remarkable progress that PEPFAR has achieved. Save almost 20 million lives in its 19 years of existence. That is about 1 million lives saved a year. We are at a point, as I said earlier, where we don't longer see HIV/AIDS in the streets. But because of that success alone, we have remarkable challenges going on to 2030. 2030 is the year we've agreed collectively as the world that we should bring HIV/AIDS to an end, which means we make it less a public health threat. So there are five things that going forward we want to be very strategic on. First is to look at those priority populations that are very vulnerable to HIV, that is the children. We are not doing as well as we're doing in adults with respect to finding the children, putting them on treatment. We should be looking at the young people, especially adolescent girls and young women, because they carry about 60% of the burden of HIV in those countries in Africa that have high prevalence of the disease. And the key population, especially the LGBTQI populations, there are issues of stigmatization, discrimination, that we should be working hard to dismantle those barriers across these three categories. HIV has now become a generational problem, where the young people that were born after 2005, I would say, when have not seen HIV. They have not seen the devastation that HIV caused. They've not seen people walking with sunken eyes and jaws or lying, walking around like skeletons. They know about HIV in textbooks, and they don't think they are at risk of being infected with HIV. So that is where it gets challenging and difficult. It is a hidden danger that HIV poses to these young people that we must actually always be aware of and focus our attention on. So that is one. Second is just because of what I described, which is the remarkable success in putting so many people on treatment and saving lives, the political visibility that HIV/AIDS had years ago has declined by several notches. So we have to sustain the response by recommitting, reinvigorating the political leadership. Political leadership matters. That's why when President Bush took on that political leadership, it transformed the fight against HIV/AIDS. That's why presidents like Festus Mohau from Botswana, when he realized that almost 60% of his country's population was infected with HIV/AIDS, took on that challenge, it mattered. In country after country that have shown political leadership, we've seen a direct correlation between that leadership and HIV impact and outcome. So second is we must sustain the response. Third is we have to strengthen those systems that we just discussed, maintain them as much as possible, laboratory systems, surveillance systems, healthcare workers, so that we can use them to complete the fight, but protect the gains that we have made in HIV/AIDS by making sure that emerging diseases like COVID and others do not disrupt our HIV response. Partnership will continue to be central. That is the fourth pillar of our strategy. Nothing of any value or any impact in the world or in humanity is done without partnership. And lastly, science has to lead us. So that's the strategy, the strategic direction that we are going with this. In all of this, we have to continue to use data to drive the programming. Data is and must remain our compass, the radar that tells us that this is where the virus is hiding, this is where we should deploy the resources. It enables us to ensure that PEPFAR continues to be accountable, transparent, and impactful.
Well, we've got to let you go for lunch here in a minute, but before we do, one last question for you. Do you think we can eradicate HIV/AIDS?
From what we have seen over the years, the last close to 20 years, offers hope that as you and I sit here and speak, we are at that pivotal moment, which is what I usually describe as the mountaintop moment, and where we are projecting our eyes and seeing with hope that by year 2030, we can bring this to an end. It will be challenging. That's why we have to think through our strategy going forward there. So I remain hopeful that with partnerships, with what I just saw in New York last week at the replenishment of the Global Fund, that the political will still be there and will drive us through the finish line in 2030. But it will not be easy. It requires that we stick together collectively.
Ambassador Nkengasong, thank you so much for taking a little time out of leading this really important work as you've really painted very clearly for us. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us some about it and for visiting us here at the Bush Center. I hope you've enjoyed your visit and that you'll come back and see us again soon.
Absolutely. And thank you for the opportunity to chat with you this morning.
You can learn more about PEPFAR's origins at the Bush Institute's Oral History of PEPFAR at www.bushcenter.org/PEPFAR. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please let us know what you thought on social media at the Bush Center on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for listening.